Hello and welcome to the RCGP podcast. My name's Dr. Thomas Round. I'm the Central Knowledge Updates Clinical Lead. And today I'm talking with Professor Carolyn Chugoyam, who is a GP and professor at Keele University. Hi, Carolyn.
Good morning. Hello.
Today we're talking about bipolar disorder.
We are. It's a really important disorder in primary and specialist care, and I think it's often overlooked. So this podcast is really important.
And just as a bit of background before we maybe start, I think you've done some research in this area, and this mental health is one of your research interests.
Yeah, mental health in the broadest sense, mental health and wellbeing across primary and specialist care. We usually focus on common mental health problems such as anxiety and depression, but I mean doing increasing work in severe mental illness, of which bipolar is one of them. And later on in the podcast, I'm going to highlight a paper that's been recently published.
That's brilliant. Thanks, Carolyn. In terms of a general sense, what do we mean by bipolar disorder?
Okay, so as I've said, bipolar disorder is a severe mental illness and it's lifelong. It's characterized by mood swings from the sort of manic highs to suicidal depression. Bipolar can affect everyone differently and it's therefore difficult to diagnose. But there are some common signs that we can use to identify the illness. So the sort of manic or hypomanic episodes, low mood, depression, suicidal thoughts with poor response to treatment. People with bipolar can also get psychotic symptoms during either the manic or the depressive episodes.
As I understand, bipolar is probably around 1% of our population registered on our GP list.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think prevalence does vary between about 0.6% and 1%. So it isn't a common disorder, but it is a really important disorder.
GPs, we obviously would have people who are diagnosed with it, and that's obviously on our list, and we can come on to that later about what maybe this yearly mental health review and making sure they're well. But I guess the key bit also is that these patients will be contacting us pre-diagnosis, and what are the challenges and difficulties in diagnosing, or I guess more actually considering bipolar disorder?
I think that's really important that we know that there's a delay of about 9.5 years between a first presentation of symptoms, which looking back may indicate bipolar disorder, to when the diagnosis is actually made. So most academics, most clinicians think that bipolar is underdiagnosed, that people struggle and live with the symptoms. Having said that, there are some other academics who say, well, actually, bipolar is overdiagnosed and we should be using the term complex emotional needs or emotionally unstable personality disorder. So there is a bit of a debate. Having said that, I think what we really want to focus on is the people who are undiagnosed. Mm-hmm. So they can live with depressive symptoms. They're often labelled as treatment-resistant depression, and these symptoms impact on function. There's obviously an increased risk of suicide. There could be undiagnosed mania or hypomania, which, you know, as I say, isn't necessarily picked up, and it can lead to consequences in terms of gambling, overspending, sexual promiscuity. People can get in trouble with the police. And despite, you know, all these what we think would be barn door symptoms and signs, they're undiagnosed because they don't think bipolar and clinicians don't think bipolar. I think increasingly people are more aware of bipolar. There's been quite a lot in the media. Some celebrities have said, you know, I've got bipolar. There's a movement on TikTok as well. There is a tool that's available for people to monitor their mood. And if you look at the Bipolar UK website, could it be bipolar? And there's a description of the symptoms on that. And there's also a mood scale. And the mood scale invites people to plot their mood from sort of feelings of hopelessness and guilt up to total loss of judgment. It invites people to plot their mood over the course of a few weeks or months, depending on the sort of cycling, and then take that to a clinician. And that can be really helpful in highlighting to individuals themselves, but also to clinicians, that there is something going on here.
I think that's really important. And as you said, that sounds like nearly 10 years research from maybe thinking about that first symptom. So I think that's so important, is it, to think about that delay and potential opportunities for earlier diagnosis. So we might have someone with depressive symptoms. And I think maybe it feeds into that continuity and follow-up, doesn't it?
Absolutely. That if you know the patient and you have a discussion with them, you've been treating them, you know, for a while with depression, you've maybe switched antidepressants, they've maybe had some talking treatments and they're not improving. It's important to think, is this bipolar? Because I think we often label people as treatment resistant depression when we haven't considered bipolar. But also, if there isn't good continuity, people are having medication reviews with different clinicians, then the opportunity for thinking and looking back through the notes and really getting to know the person, we lose that opportunity to think whether it's bipolar or not. I think at the other end of the scale is that the episodes of hypomania may be quite welcomed by an individual because they're extra creative, they don't need to have as much sleep, they may be productive. And so actually, that's really great. And particularly if somebody has episodes where they feel really low and they're in bed all the time, they've got no motivation, it impacts on their work, then having those periods of productivity is great. So they may not consult about those. So we as clinicians just see them when they are down, depressed and hopeless. So I mentioned earlier that there's a study that I was involved in where we found that there were signals that might prompt a GP to suspect bipolar disorder. And again, I think this does rely on looking at the patient's records and knowing the patient. But looking over the 10 years before a bipolar diagnosis is made, there are things that are recorded, such as sleep disturbance or insomnia, substance misuse, mood swings, anxiety, a label of personality disorder, where the GP ought to be thinking, gosh, all these things have happened. And often you'll see in a problem list a number of different diagnoses, anxiety, stress-related symptoms, depression, personality disorder. And we really need to start thinking, is this bipolar?
That's really useful. Thank you. And thinking about the triggers in the notes, and you mentioned things like substance misuse, that can be more common. And as I say, it's not us GPs making that diagnosis, is it? It's thinking about considering the diagnosis and when to refer for an assessment.
Absolutely. It's not a diagnosis that GPs should be making, but we should be thinking about it because we're the gateway to a specialist care referral. And it's really important to provide a really good comprehensive history in order to get the patient seen. And if it's accompanied by the person filling in a mood scale so that you've got some other evidence of, you know, this is possibly bipolar, what do you think? I think that helps the referral.
I've done a bit of psychiatric training and I remember seeing some manic episodes, and when people are very manic and unwell, you really know it. But often people can have hypomania, right? And that's, as you say, people, they maybe quite enjoy it after if they've been having a sort of period of feeling low.
Absolutely. So I think if somebody is manic, psychotic, they often end up in the emergency department. And in a way, the diagnosis is easier to make. It's those episodes of hypomania where they can be quite valued by a person and they're therefore not taken as a problem to the GP.
I understand there's bipolar 1 and bipolar 2, and I get slightly confused about this, and I don't suggest that we have to know fully the difference, but maybe we could just touch on that briefly.
Yes, I mean, there is a difference, and psychiatrists will often label people as bipolar 1 and 2. And I think you're right. Does it matter in general practice? I think the important thing is that we suspect it and make a referral. But briefly, bipolar disorder 1, DSM talks about a one episode of mania, which has got things like restlessness, euphoria, not sleeping, risk-taking, disinhibition. And that often leads to inpatient care. So that's the sort of people who will end up in the emergency department or police station with a good going mania. And so in a way, that's possibly more easy to diagnose. Whereas bipolar 2, there's a major depressive episode plus one hypomanic episode. And it's often that hypomanic episode that's missed, that the patient isn't aware of, the clinician doesn't ask about. Because I think this is really important. When we're seeing people who we think, oh, this is treatment-resistant depression, I don't know what to do, they've tried 4 antidepressants. It's really important to say, can I just ask, have you ever had episodes where you feel really creative, you don't need much sleep, you're really productive at work or in your studies? Has that ever happened? And they may say, oh yes, actually, and that's great because I'm not depressed anymore. And that's the clue. And the other thing is to really ask about family history of bipolar disorder, because, you know, there is a link. And again, that can be a clue where you're dealing with somebody, you're not quite sure what's going on, then ask about family history. And in fact, what I do now is when somebody comes in with a new depressive illness, I also ask about family history of bipolar as well as family history of depression.
And as I say, usual when we assess these patients, we'd risk assess, wouldn't we, about who's at home, any thoughts of harm. So won't necessarily go into that in detail today. But I guess the key thing, as you said, is thinking about the diagnosis, asking their questions. It's tough. We have short time consultations. I think it's really making sure we have the time and the space and the continuity to ask those questions and feel confident in that assessment.
Absolutely. So, continuity, following people up, being proactive and thinking, you know, when you're struggling with a person, you know, why are they not getting better or what's going on here? If you're having those thoughts, then the next thought should be, is this bipolar?
And then, as we say, yeah, it's that sort of assessment. Everyone will have different referral pathways. We're pretty quick in our local area. You know, if I'm worried, I can flag something up reasonably quickly for an assessment. I know, obviously, some areas struggle with waiting lists and referrals. And it's also useful having that discussion, isn't it, with secondary care, with your psychiatric colleagues?
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes people, if they're in a hypomanic phase or if they're very depressed with suicidal ideation, then getting the crisis team or the home-based treatment team involved is important. In my locality, that's relatively straightforward and the teams are responsive. I think GPs struggle to get a routine psychiatrist opinion. So that's why it's really important to get a really good history and get the patient to complete the mood scale and send that on so that you've got lots of evidence to say this person needs a psychiatrist to look at them, to assess them, to think about whether it's bipolar, because I can't make that diagnosis. And I actually write that in the letter, that it's not a diagnosis that a GP can make. I'm relying on you to, but I really suspect bipolar.
And that's really important.
Sometimes a person will come in and think they've got bipolar and we'll talk about it. And sometimes we agree they probably haven't. But sometimes, you know, well, there's a possibility, although it could be a UPD. And actually, you know, I'm saying to the psychiatrist, I really want you to help me out here. Can we try and come to a diagnosis? Because then we can come to a management plan for this person.
And I think that's really helpful just to reflect on, you know, patients, you've got depression, maybe your first line antidepressants aren't working, you're following them up, you've got that continuity. Really do ask about that family history, anything, as you said, around the potential hypomania or mania symptoms. Do ask those questions. So once a patient then, I think that's obviously the crux of it, the key bits for GP, but we'll have patients then that we follow up and or we referred in and the diagnosis is made. What's the common treatments? Obviously, we wouldn't necessarily initiate those, but we would take over the long-term prescribing in a safe way.
Yeah, absolutely. So psychoeducation is really important. Sleep routine. Often disturbed sleep is something that is a symptom of somebody becoming either depressed or hypomanic. But actually poor sleep hygiene can precipitate a hypomanic episode in some people. So education about sleep is really important. Obviously avoidance of substance misuse and signposting people to support groups such as Bipolar UK. We wouldn't initiate drugs, but the most effective still is thought to be lithium. Valproate is a possibility, but obviously not in women of childbearing age. And then the psychiatrist might think about lamotrigine or quetiapine or olanzapine. But obviously with the antipsychotics, there's the risk of physical health problems, increasing weight, metabolic problems such as hyperlipidemia, diabetes. So it is up to the psychiatrist working with the patients and hopefully liaising with general practice about what's the best drug combination. Some people with bipolar who get particular depressive episodes can be started on antidepressant. But obviously, if you give an antidepressant, there is a risk of precipitating mania. So again, be very careful. If you've got somebody who's stable on lithium and they come in and they're depressed, if you're going to give an antidepressant, really low doses, go up very carefully and review. And if you don't feel comfortable doing it as a GP, I think we ought to be able to get people seen back in secondary care to say, this person's on lithium, but their moods aren't stable, they're getting depression. What do you think? And as I said already, that, you know, antidepressants on their own are not an effective treatment for bipolar. And we should be thinking, when somebody's got depression, that is it getting better? Is this bipolar? And then psychological interventions. So NICE suggests psychological interventions, high intensity cognitive behavioural therapy. It's whether that's available, isn't it? And it varies in different localities.
Obviously, GP, we have an important role. We would often be taking over prescribing once initiated in a safe way. And as you said, often in our practice, we would do the lithium monitoring, for example. We'd have them on our SMI register. We would daily health check blood pressure, weight, cholesterol, diabetes check, etc.
That's really important role for the GP. I think, again, it's about liaison across primary and specialist care, because some people end up having two physical health checks. They have monitoring both in secondary care and primary care, and some people miss out on them. So it's really important that people with bipolar are coded as such, are on the Severe Mental Illness Register, Quality and Outcomes Framework, the QAF, so their physical health check annually. But also if they're on lithium, then regular lithium monitoring along with urea and electrolytes and thyroid function, according to the NICE guidelines. But I think it's not just about managing physical health. It's also in general practice about continuity, about supporting that person, knowing whether the person has any signs or symptoms of relapse. Often people will have a mental health plan. They'll have worked this out with the community mental health team. They know that if they take cannabis, they have a relapse, or if they get poor sleep because they're stressed, they might become hypomanic. So they create themselves a plan of early warning symptoms. And it's really important that the person has that, but also that's documented in the GP records so that the GP is aware of it and can say, when somebody comes in or when they contact the practice, maybe through an online query system, this person's got bipolar. Have they got an early warning plan? What do I need to do about this? Do we need to act today? And I think the other thing that GPs have responsibility for is supporting people to stay in work. So giving fit notes if they're needed, but that fit note may be fit for work, so that somebody who's maybe a little bit unstable but feels that work gives them a structure and they don't want to be off work, they have a maybe fit for work, and they can negotiate with their line manager what sort of work they can do whilst they're unwell, because we do know that work on the whole is beneficial to people's mental and physical health.
We touched on earlier on, Caroline, about the family history. There is that sort of link. Do we know any other potential causes or patients that would be more at risk of bipolar, and I guess also what the long-term outcomes are as well?
There's not a great deal of evidence around the cause of bipolar disorder. It seems that, you know, men and women can be affected, any social, demographic, any ethnic background. The triggers are often stress, family stress, emotional stress, work stress, and substance abuse. But for women, it can also be triggered by childbirth. So there's a, you know, postpartum bipolar disorder, postpartum psychosis, and by the menopause. And I've seen a couple of women in my years of practice who have been perimenopausal and have presented with an acute psychosis and been diagnosed with bipolar. In terms of long-term outcomes, I mean, the outcomes are poor because of the late diagnosis, but also we know that people with severe mental illness will die 15 years earlier than they would have done if they didn't have that severe mental illness, because of sort of genetics, we think, and inflammatory markers, but also because of the lifestyle. So people may be more inclined to smoke, or may be sedentary, or may have a diet that perhaps increases their risk of diabetes or high lipids, but also the drugs we give them. So I've mentioned already antipsychotics, and these are commonly used in bipolar. And when somebody's on an antipsychotic, we know they put on about 12 kilograms in that first few months. We know that their lipids can become deranged. We know that they have an increased risk of diabetes. So people with a severe mental illness, including bipolar disorder, can die 15 years earlier because of physical health problems. So it's really important in general practice that we take their physical health check seriously. I'm sure people are aware of the Leicester resource, which says don't just screen, intervene. I think we're very good in general practice at doing the physical health check. The boxes are ticked, the blood tests are done. We may be less good at saying, well, this person has raised lipids, or this person's got a raised HbA1c, or this person smokes. What are we going to do about it? And so I believe that people with severe mental illness shouldn't just have the health check, but they should have a follow-up assessment, a follow-up review with their usual GP, or, you know, another clinician with expertise in this area, to go through that. Well, what are the risk factors? What's the Q risk 3? Do they need to be started on a statin earlier than somebody without bipolar, without severe mental illness? Do we need to offer smoking cessation advice? And of course, we know that a lot of smoking cessation services were cut during austerity, and practices vary in the amount of support they're able to give to people who smoke. But I think we have a responsibility to really take physical health seriously.
I think that's so important, isn't it? As you say about that gap, age, life expectancy gap, if you have SMI and not just doing the health check, but actually thinking about how can I intervene? What difference can we make? My interest area is in cancer, and we know that uptake of cancer screening is lower people with SMI. So I think as part of that check, it's actually saying, you know, once you get to 60, it is dropping, doing your fit test every 2 years, come to the post. Breast check, you know, thinking about cancers, because they are at higher risk for, as you say, cardiovascular disease and cancers.
Yep, absolutely. And then the other thing that we forget in people with severe mental illness is oral health. We know that people who have got severe mental illness have admissions to hospital, they have sepsis and dental abscesses. And we know there's a link between periodontal disease and diabetes, so it compounds the risk. And of course, people with severe mental illness may not be able to get a dentist. There's, you know, a really big health inequality there. So I think general practice has a big role to play in supporting the physical health of people with bipolar.
And you're doing research. Think about any research in this area, and maybe where next in this topic?
Yes. I am involved in some research. And one of the research questions in the NICE guideline was, you know, what's the best drug treatment for bipolar? So I'm involved in a trial where we're using aripiprazole and sertraline for the treatment of bipolar depression. And that's aripiprazole and sertraline in combination versus quetiapine. And hopefully we're going to come up with an answer. I'm really hoping that the aripiprazole, I shouldn't say this, I'm not in equipoise, obviously, but, you know, if we're giving quetiapine to somebody with bipolar, they've got all the physical health problems, whereas aripiprazole is a much lower risk antipsychotic. So there's a, you know, a good reason from the physical health point of view that hopefully that would be more effective. But currently the evidence is that actually lithium is probably the best drug to be using.
And yeah, just to summarise, I think really we touched on the sort of top tips to think about bipolar, to have maybe some stock questions when you're doing a depression review or having those flag in your mind to think about it and when to refer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think do direct people to the Bipolar UK website. And this could be people who've got treatment resistant depression or people you think might have bipolar or they think they might have bipolar. Look at the mood scale, get them to fill that in. And emphasising again, continuity is so important for people with bipolar disorder, but people with mental health problems in general.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. It's always a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you so much, Thomas.
Thank you very much. And as I say, if you want to learn more, we've got some other content on the BJGP website, recent papers on bipolar. Do check out our e-learning web pages as well for more resources on mental health and bipolar. And again, just thank you for listening. This is the RCGP podcast. I'm Dr. Thomas Round. Thank you very much.